Ready to order, and I'm going to. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3745. Diane.
Right, Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 3745 repeals a sunset on a provision dealing with taking runaway child into protective custody. It declares an emergency. Now, I did, behind the SMS that I very briefly outlined for you, give you a copy of the chapter 691 that you could see has a sunset on the chapter, and this bill will repeal that. One of the reasons I understand that there had been a sunset placed on the appeal, on the law, was that there were concerns that perhaps children of color or minority children might be targeted in some negative way by the law. And at this point, most of the existing persons working with children are runaways and children. With at-risk behavior are all decided that that's not what's happening, that this is a good thing, and that the sunset can be repealed.
Okay.
I also gave you a piece of testimony that you'll be hearing from the next witness at your place. So there is a piece of testimony from Kitty Piercy for House Bill 3745 that was sitting at your place when you arrived.
Yeah, call up Representative Ackerman and the former vice chair of this committee, Kitty Piercy.
I
seem to remember this from
about
2 years ago. So.
Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Robert Ackerman. I'm a state representative from District 39, which is North and West Eugene. 2 years ago, I was a constituent of Kitty Piercy. Now she's my constituent. Very proud to be with her today and advocate for the adoption of House Bill 3745. In just very, very general and simple terms, the current law allows runaways to be taken into protective custody with ultimately a release to parents or to a shelter facility. As was mentioned earlier, this provision sunsets, and the purpose of this bill would be to repeal that sunset. If there's anything that's first in our minds as we progress through the legislative process, it's not only a balanced budget, it's not only fiscal responsibility, but really number one is how we treat our kids and how we treat kids that find themselves in the streets. And for those reasons, children that are runaways should have some shelter, have some alternative to reunite with their families, and the repeal of this sunset would be imperative to give them the best break out of the worst of circumstances in some instances. That's really all I have, because my comments were mostly introductory, and I would now turn the microphone over to any questions or to my colleague, Kitty Piercy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Representative Ackerman's covered this pretty well. Kitty Piercy, Eugene, Oregon.
I forgot that.
That's right. And a member of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And this testimony that you have before you today is actually written by Galen Phipps, who runs a shelter in Eugene, Oregon, Looking Glass Shelter, and he wrote some testimony supporting House Bill 3745. I just have a couple comments to make. One is that 2 years ago, actually, Representative Cruz and I, Chair Cruz and I, were on a larger committee to deal with juvenile crime prevention issues, and that was composed of county people and city people. And this bill actually came out of that, the work of that group. In our community, the mayor, the truancy officer from Springfield, the ACLU, parents, city people all got together and tried to figure out how we could improve our services for runaway and homeless youth. And one of the things that the law enforcement folks said to us was that the current law was so ambiguous that a lot of law enforcement folks just didn't deal with it. So we sought to clarify the law, And what we did was simply say that when you see a youngster in danger, you can pick them up and you can try to unite them with their family if that's appropriate, or take them to a shelter where someone can work with them to unite them with their family, or find them permanent housing in some other way. So I'll tell you that as you heard earlier, that there was some concern that this might be used to profile in some way some kids. And so before we brought this back to have the sunset removed, we called folks all over the state to ask how this was working. Sure. And they did say that there's not enough shelter for kids. There's not enough places for kids who are homeless and were runaway to go, but that this has helped. And they hope that we will remove the sunset and have it become part of the permanent law. And so that's what we're asking today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Are you having a great session, huh?
We have our moments. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Janet Inez. Okay. In that case, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3745 and open a work session on House Bill 3745. Representative Morsak.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3745 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morsak moves House Bill 3745 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker? Aye. Representative Cromwell? Aye. Representative Morrison? Aye. Representative Gerard? Aye. Representative Monsanto? Aye. Representative Lee? Aye. Representative Barnhart? Aye. Chair Cruz? Aye.
House Bill 3745, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative,
yep. I recommend that I move that this bill be on the consent agenda.
Representative Tomei has moved that House Bill 3745 be added to the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3745.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I am going to open a public hearing on 3214. Colleagues, I really don't want to get into this issue. We are going to send this bill to Ways and Means. What we have discovered is that if they have this in Ways and Means, that this is going to allow them to access some federal funds. And so I thought that would be way cool. So,
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3214 be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Could we wait till I close the public hearing and go into work session?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3214 and open a work session. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3214 be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 3214 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker? Aye. Representative Tomei? Aye. Representative Cromwell? Aye. Representative Morrison? Aye. Representative Gerard? Aye. Representative Monsanto? Aye. Representative Lee? Aye. Representative Barnhart? Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3214, having received the required majority, is declared passed. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3214. And I'm going to open a public hearing on, well, before I do that, just for those in the crowd who may be wondering about this long list, yeah, I want to say now for the record that the last two bills on page one, all the bills on page two and the bills on page three are for the purpose of TAP hearings. There is going to be no testimony. We should do all of that within 10 minutes if we're lucky and I can talk fast. So having said that, I will open a public hearing on HJR 65. Diane.
Good. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 65 establishes a 10-year goal to address the need for affordable housing for low-income Oregonians by 2011. It sets a biennial appropriation target of $60 million to address affordable housing needs by the year 2011.
Thank you. Okay, Jerry Beberly. Thought it's appropriate to have you first because this is the Jerry Beberly Memorial Bill, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah, but it's probably Memorial.
Well, I thought, that'd be enough. I'm sorry, I should have picked a different term.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Beberly, and I am one of the co-chairs of the Human Services Coalition. I have an attachment on my view about page 4, which should tell you who the members are. It's pretty extensive. It's has almost all the lobbyists who have some interest in housing. Now, that's not to say every time we meet, they all show up. But just say if something really hot comes up, like maybe real estate transfer tax or something, we'll get a full membership very quickly. When we started this, someone said to me, why do you want a resolution? What's it get you? And what it gets us is that we've had a very hard time, as you all know, getting any attention on housing during the session. And the reason is we have to go a three-step process every session because we start from scratch. So, you know, we have to educate legislators on housing is a problem. And then we have to get them to understand it's a statewide problem, something the legislature should have an interest in. And by the time we get around to say maybe this is a solution, we're into May, and there's no place to go because time's over. So we thought if we could get a resolution that everyone could get agreement on that has some positive impact, sentiments about housing, that we could use that to work through the interim with candidates and legislators to say, you know, this is the problem, this is what it is, and we're off and running. Now, I understand very clearly this resolution commits no legislature or legislator to any particular course of action, and it's not intended to do that, and that's not the issue. So, and also I would like to note that this resolution is a product between the Housing Lobby Coalition and about 7 House members who have been meeting the co-sponsors on the bill, dealing with housing issues, and we all decide this is a good way to start. I could go over need, but I don't think I need to take the committee's time to do that. There's about 111,000 low-income people without adequate housing today. And the other point that has changed radically in the last few years, the housing problem no longer extends just to low-income people. It's moved up the scale, and it's got moderate-income people very involved in housing. So if you would look at the whereas, you would see that it really talks more about housing as a problem, not focused on low-income until you get down towards the end of it. I've got a chart that shows how we developed the number 50 million. If it's right behind the membership list, and what we're looking for is a goal. I emphasize it's a goal. $30 million for new development of housing, and roughly would split it up this way. $22 million for development, $22 million $3 million for farm workers, some low-income ownership programs and community capacity building programs, and that comes out to 30. And the next 20 basically deals, the first two items are homeless assistance programs. And then we put $8 million in for a new program that's never been funded, never been discussed. But what we have found in a number of areas in the state, particularly when you get out to central and eastern Oregon, the structure is not the problem. The structures are there. It's the problem getting the low-income person and the landlord connected so that they can pay an adequate rent to make their structure profitable. So we were looking at the idea at some time developing a rental assistance that could be spotted through the state when those situations occur and try to deal with that situation. And then the last $10 million is a contribution to the trust fund. The original idea of the trust fund in 1991 is we'd fund it up to $175 million and then load thereafter on the interest. Things like ballot measure 511 and economic downturns has prevented us since 1993 making any contribution to the trust fund. So that is no longer our basic strategy. If you flip the next page, you'll find out that we're not starting from zero, that there are about $19 million, 19 and a half, in the governor's base budget this session. Presuming we can hang on to those, though the goal is only is 50, we only need 30 to get there. So it's not as grim as we initially make it sound. On my written testimony, and I'm not going to go over it necessarily with you, but there's a chart showing the history of funding for housing and since 1991. It would have been on page 2 if I would have labeled it. But
I recreated it on the SMS.
And what it tells you, if you take out the one-time contribution for the trust fund in 1991, the housing budget has stayed steady or decreased since 2001. So we haven't even been able to get the normal inflationary impact increases. So we've got a job in front of us, and we think that this resolution will help us get there.
Question.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Bob Repine.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martinez is wondering why he's been skipped over.
Where is it?
No, he's that's hiding back there.
Oh, I was looking the wrong place. Okay. Do you want him to come up with
well, I just feel like he's...
Jim, you want to come up? Like I didn't mean to slight you.
It's easy to overlook. You can imagine.
He was hunched down.
There's a reason for that.
Be people's minds from across the room.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. I'm here to speak in favor of the joint resolution that you have in front of you. I think Jerry did a great job of talking about the circumstances and issues that we are faced in Oregon, and we have been faced for many years, as he alludes back to 91 when the trust fund was developed. Those issues that were there present in 1991 are still there and probably have moved to a higher degree of need in the last 10 years. I think the most important part of the bill is the emphasis that we need to have a plan. We need to have a philosophy in mind of how we're going to get to deal with things in a period of time. Can we build our way out of the issue that currently we're faced with? No, we cannot. There's not enough money to do that. Can we figure out other ways and other opportunities to take advantage of inventory that's either there today in communities and is proposed to be built and use it more effectively and more efficiently for the citizens who need it? And I think that's the bigger challenge. How do we take advantage and utilize the resources that we have, that we know we'll have over a period of time? And how do we best utilize the inventory of housing that's out there in the marketplace to its highest and best use? No longer in the days of new construction, one of the things that we look at on a regular basis in my department is we weigh the question of, is it new construction or acquisition rehabilitation? In today's cost environment, it costs us twice as much to build something than it does to acquire something and renovate it to a standard of acceptable living conditions that you would expect in a dwelling today. And so those are the trade-offs that are being made on a day-to-day basis in the state. We need to figure out how those trade-offs will continue. We're also going into a time in the state of Oregon, as other states are going into, as there will be a tremendous amount of both federal rural development loans and HUD loans that are expiring or coming to their conclusion. These were loans that were taken out in the early 70s, and they had 30-year mortgages on them. And what you end up having is going to have a series of landowners or property owners who are probably, if you were to characterize them, they are the original owners that started these programs back in the 70s. They've held those investment properties for the full term. They have probably become senior property owners in the sense that they have aged along with the property, and they are now trying to decide whether or not they still want to have rental property in their portfolio, or should they be wanting to sell it and move on to do other things in their later life. And so with that in mind, there's a tremendous amount of resources of what is now considered affordable housing stock in Oregon that is there today, but will start being rolled off and potentially, as we call it, flipping over to marketplace. And so we need to have a strong strategy in mind of how we're going to make sure that we, the state, and our partners are there at the front of that line to identify where those properties are so we can make reasonable and respectable offers on those properties to keep them in the affordable components of the state's use as opposed to losing them, which means if we lose them, then we once again are forced to saying if they're lost, do we go out and build new? And we're building new at twice the cost of recovering and holding. And so these are the challenges, and a 10-year plan with those kind of challenges in mind makes sense, and it does cause a focus to come, I think, after 10 years of waiting for the Housing Trust Fund to be totally seeded with $170 million, it should be more of a living document of what's going to go on in the next 10 years as you, as members, and other members will come to this Capitol to discuss the issues about affordable housing.
Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, also here on behalf of the UFL, which I'll say a little bit more in a second. But for those of you who don't know or weren't around in 1991, and because of term limits, I don't think anybody at the dais was, Mr. Repine, or then Representative Repine, is kind of the godfather for the Housing Trust Fund in Oregon. It was his legislation in 91 that, that passed and developed the trust fund. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to fund it at the level it needs to be at, and we continue to try to get there, and hopefully in some future legislative session we will succeed at that. The United Financial Lobby is also very strong supporters of this legislation. That includes not only the Oregon Bankers Association, but the Mortgage Bankers Association, the Mortgage Brokers, the Oregon Credit Union Association of Oregon, the consumer finance companies as well. So we all agree that we need to do something on housing. There's been a lot of issues this session, as there are in every session, on what's the best way to do it. And we look at HJR 65 as really a reasonable approach and an opportunity to lay out what is the way we ought to proceed in the future. So we strongly encourage your support of this legislation.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, having gone through the legislative process, and you know much more about it than I do, what are we going to be able to accomplish with this memorial? What do you see as the next step and ongoing goals for this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, joint resolutions are, you know, have no effect of law. They don't deliver either resources or manpower. But I think what it does give, it brings us to a focus. There has been, for years, discussions about housing issues, and we have a variety of approaches and ways to address the issue have been discussed over the last 10 years. I think what the Housing Coalition have brought to you is they what they believe is the base principles of where we should be today and how we should go in the future. And so I think it gives everybody some common ground to say, okay, this is where we're starting, because we all agree this is our starting point. And now we have some place that we can build from on how we're going to accomplish the daunting task of housing Oregonians. Up to this time, it's just been a matter of opinion on how people might feel one way or the other. But this way, you've got everybody, at least a document that would be could be held up and said, okay, we've all agreed this is our starting point, and this is where the principles begin. And I think that's what the bill will bring us.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Morissa. Thank you. Mr. Repine. I was going to carry a really good bill that from you about land banking, and I heard you mention a minute ago the ability to tie up some of this property that might be lost. Now, is that land banking bill, maybe I'm using that's a generic term, but is that still a viable piece of legislation that is lying around on someone's shelf right now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the bill still has a very important part of what we believe are some of those future actions that the state should take relative to making housing available and affordable. Generally, land banking or the bill would apply to us acquiring lands that are not developed yet but could be found. I'll give you a good example. We work very closely with the Department of Transportation, and in the Portland area, we work very closely to Metro, trying that area, and work with them on lands that they have acquired over time that could be very desirable building lands that other agencies, state agencies, have first kind of crack at. If we're in a position to buy those and preserve them and then put together a loan to, around it, we can offer a loan and the property that's located very geographically positive to the community without trying to search to find one out. So our bill is land banking more than acquisition.
Well, as the person who's going to carry that bill and as vice chair of this committee, should I ask our chair to resurrect that bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as all things happen in life, it'll good things come along in the proper time.
I assume that's a yes. That's a good theory. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that is real critical in the state of Oregon statewide, and I've seen such a need. But I would hope that the emphasis is going to be for the very low income. I think that's where the greatest need is. We are starting to get some more low-income housing. Have you looked at where the emphasis is going to be, guidelines, or is this just real broad?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have a variety of funding opportunities that we offer our partners in the state of Oregon. One, which is the more common one that many of our partners go after, is the one that has the federal tax credits and Oregon tax credits and a series of other federal programs. And why I point that out is it's those resources that when you apply them to either acquisition rehabilitation or the construction of a new facility, and if you're dealing with special needs population, people who are least than able to pay a reasonable going rate for rent, then you use those resources to be able to get to income levels that are probably on the average of 30% and below median income, which is somebody who lives on SSI for all practical purposes. The council, the housing council, who gives my department direction, has over the last 2 years has been very focused on driving those applications, those awards of those applications to the away from the 60% median income and driving them down to 50% and below. And I would tell you in the last 2 years we probably have in excess of 70% of the units that we put online on an annual basis are units that are at 50% and below, which generally up until that time it was the other way. 70% were above 50% and 30% were below. So the council has taken a very strong position on funding more needier populations with that resource. We still hold other lending programs that we have, which are our risk loans and our conduit financing, to deal with those populations at 60% and possibly above, because there are still housing needs, as I think Mr. Baberly talked about, that because we have working people now who are not in any kind of situation with state subsidy, they're making minimum wage job or maybe even better. Today, the living rate for a single person with a child is $12.97 if they're going to pay for rent, pay for their food, pay for their other costs that they have. And so you can see that still, even for somebody who's no longer on a subsidy with the state or any kind of federal program, is still having a very difficult time finding affordable housing, even though they are still making almost $13 an hour. And so we also are mindful of the fact that the gap is starting to happen in the higher end also. They're clearly two different populations, but we try to make that decision based on those funding resources that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that originally you had some money in the budget or the proposal for farm worker housing, but that was removed later. Could you explain a little bit about what was in mind at that point and what happened subsequently?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, are you referring to HJR 65?
The HLC request that's on this handout.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that handout.
Okay.
I think probably in the original request that we submitted for budgetary purposes, there was much of the same split of those dollars that were reported in our recommendation of the governor's budget. Based on the budget difficulties of this session and cuts that had to be made in my department and other departments, those resources were not accepted in the final version of the governor's budget.
Thank you.
Another question? Senator Mona Sanderson.
There is a real need for farm worker housing. Just from the fact working in Clackamas County and going out, so I would hope that will still stay on the radar screen because we needed to make sure that we provide adequate housing or have adequate housing available to our farming community.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in another subsequent committee, we have presented the findings of the $1 million that was awarded last session, which was referred to as the Migrant Million. That was handled by my department and was put out through an RFP process. We were able to take that $1 million and create $14 million of housing by leveraging our resources against the either providers or farm agricultural owners to make housing available, and we created over 400 units. I can give you a copy of that report if you'd like to see it. It shows you both both the geographical location, who the focus group was on the population, and what type of housing was being bought for those resources. It's a pretty overwhelming leverage of dollars.
Bob, you can just give that report to Diane so that the whole committee can have it.
And, Mr. Chairman, along with that bill, there was a subsequent bill that also moved from that committee that would is requesting $5 million to be reconsidered as a for farm worker housing in a companion piece of legislation.
Representative Girard.
I know Mr. Martinez and I know Mr. Repine are both aware of this, but I wanted to make sure that Representative Motis Anderson is aware. I know she is, too. Because of a lack of water in the Klamath Basin, I think we have a lot of migrant farm worker vacancies for housing available. If we could work on the transportation issue, we might be able to do something.
It'd be a long commute.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think Mr. Chairman, Mr. Girard has an interesting point. We're in the because it had been a very healthy economy in the agricultural units down in the Klamath area. We have just recently funded a program that's going to be breaking ground, that's going to deliver some other housing because of what was then a need with the change in the issues around the drought. It makes that project become both, you know, questionable on its success, and also there we know that in some of the outlying areas of the Klamath geographical area, there are communities that are literally families are picking up and leaving and moving to other jobs, and that's leaving a great void in those communities and a lot of housing that's not being used in today's market.
Thank you for that comment, Bob. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Jana Jarvis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I'm from the Oregon Association of Realtors. We're a trade association of nearly 13,000 members statewide. I don't have a great deal to add to what's been stated already, other than the fact that home ownership is certainly one of our basic tenets in our philosophy, and we want to support any and all efforts to address issues as they relate to the state and housing issues in the state of Oregon. We do also have some national research that I would like to make available to interested parties that address issues of home ownership and housing affordability as it relates to affordable rental properties as well. And so I did want to make that available to both the committee and to any and all parties, because we're certainly interested in finding solutions for this state, and we would like to support this joint resolution as well. Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah. Representative Morissette.
Jana, I appreciate your testimony. If we could put all of the money collected into purchasing low-income housing, I'm talking about purchasing, would you favor a real estate transfer tax for that purpose?
We don't find a real estate transfer tax is the right solution for affordable housing.
That I'd ask.
Good answer. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 65 and open a work session on HJR 65. Representative Morissette.
Mr. Chair, I move HJR 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves HJR 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye.
Representative
Hummel?
Aye.
Representative Morissette? Aye. Representative Gillard? Aye. Representative Montanison? Aye. Representative Lee? Aye. Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz? Aye. House Joint Resolution 65, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I know somebody wants to carry it, but since Representative Barnhart is one of the sponsors, would you like to carry it?
I would be happy to. I wonder if Representative Merkley, who is the chief sponsor, wants it.
My sense is he will probably speak to it, so.
I'd be happy to carry it.
Okay. Sure. Representative Barnhart will carry. Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on HJR 65. Open the public hearing on HCR 6. Diane.
Rachel.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, HCR 6 acknowledges a benefit private and fraternal organizations provide to the residents of Oregon.
Lenny Park.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lanny Parr, representing private and fraternal organizations in the Oregon Moose Association, which is approximately about 300,000 members statewide. And HCR 6 simply recognizes the role that fraternal organizations play in our local communities. Providing community service is an integral component of fraternal organizations. They raise millions of dollars annually and put in thousands and thousands of volunteer hours each year into community projects. And we just really appreciate the opportunity to have some public awareness and acknowledgement of what they provide to the local communities. To give you an example of some of the things that they've done, the Oregon Eagles have donated just last year $3 million that went towards projects such as cancer research, youth drug abuse programs, local homeless shelters, and other programs. And the Oregon Moose have raised $2 million last year. And some of their money went towards Special Olympics, Bosnia orphan programs, and homeless shelters for vets, and developing a smart reading program. And essentially, HCR 6 is just a great opportunity to provide public awareness for their volunteer efforts, and we just thank you for the opportunity.
Questions? Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to note, as we talk about this resolution, that one of the ways in which the United States is unique in the world is that Americans regularly clump together in voluntary organizations of one kind or another for the purpose of bettering their own communities. This is not something which is known in other parts of the world, except as fraternal organizations and groups like the Rotary Club take these ideas out to other places. And it makes a huge difference in the way the United States runs and the way our communities work, because local needs are handled by local people that way. And I want to thank you very much for coming to testify on this bill, and thank Representative Close for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
Representative, I'd point out we have some fine fraternal organizations in Douglas County, but they don't clump together. They come together, but
I was thinking about individuals too, Mr. Chair, rather than what organizations do. I stand corrected. Thank you.
Thank you. You don't know what it is. Right?
She's on that education side, but she's leading that one. So. Okay, we'll just move the bill then. Okay. The committee, we're looking for Representative Close, so we'll stand at ease for a minute. Well, we won't stand at ease at all then. We'll just ask Representative Close to come up and.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Cruz and members of the House Committee on Health and Public Advocacy for hearing its HCR 6. I'm Betsy Close, State Representative from District 36, Albany, Millersburg, Tangent, parts of Corvallis. HCR 6 acknowledges the benefits that private and fraternal organizations provide to the residents of Oregon. One might be tempted to respond, well, everybody knows that. But far from being an obvious notion, private nonprofits are increasingly being eyed by government entities as an opportunity to tax and raise revenue for state and local governments. To do so would severely jeopardize the ability of these organizations to operate their programs that help so many. Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCAs, Elks, Masons, Crisis Pregnancy Centers, Teen Challenge, Drug Abuse Centers, hundreds of charities and religious organizations would suffer and be severely curtailed. The beauty of the work these groups do can be expressed in two words, volunteer and private. This is as American as John Wayne and apple pie. I urge the committee to vote to make this important statement and to pass HCR 6 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Any questions? Representative, you want to carry it? Should we, for some reason, pass it?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 6 and open a work session on HCR 6. Representative Morsap.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 6 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Morsap moves HCR 6 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Morrison? Aye.
Representative
Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Montanson?
Aye.
Representative
Lee?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart? Aye. HCR 6, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and Representative Close will carry. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on HCR 6. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3479. Diane.
Good.
Okay, chairperson and members of the committee, House Bill 3479, in its purest form, original form, modifies conditions, manner, and purpose of disciplinary action against emergency medical technicians. This bill, I did attach dash one amendments. Is there consensus amendments that were worked out among all stakeholders? And I believe they're here to speak on the bill. I also have handed Gross the bill with the dash one amendments. Rachel can get this to you right away. I thought they might help be a little easier to see, look at the amendments if they were actually handing Gross into the bill. So, I
want
to get that to you.
Okay, I'll call up Tom Johnson and Bob Livingston. Afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Johnson, an assistant administrator with the Oregon Health Division of the Department of Human Services. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3479 with the dash one amendments. We've met with Pat West, the president of the Oregon Firefighters Council, and with their legal counsel, Mr. Greg Hartman, to develop mutually acceptable language, which was referred to. This language is incorporated in the dash one amendments. The results of this bill with the dash one amendments address certain concerns with the existing emergency medical technician, EMT, professional standards and disciplinary process used by the health division. The goal of this legislation is to improve the system for dealing with professional standards and the disciplinary process for EMTs. The legislation focuses on making the professional standards disciplinary process more sensitive to the rights of those individuals which are being investigated, while also at the same time preserving the core purpose of protecting the health and safety of all Oregonians while they are in the care of emergency medical service providers. In meeting with the Oregon Firefighters Council, four general concerns were identified. First, the tone and the physical setup of what is referred to as informal interviews was addressed. Second, the due process concerns relating to the purpose for investigations and the charges of people being investigated was addressed. Third, consideration of completed employer or physician supervisor discipline, which may have already occurred before the health division became involved, was addressed. And fourth, the issue of discipline as it relates to off-duty activities of EMTs was addressed. The first concern, that of tone of the interview process itself and the physical setup, has already been addressed internally within the health division due to our own internal looking at the process and what was taking place. We believe that agreement is reached on that issue for, from our own activity for things that we had control of. The first issue addressed, well, in addition to that informal process, we also jointly developed language about language that would be given to individuals who are the subject of investigations as they were interviewed so that they could know of their rights and the process that was about to unfold. We removed the term informal from the language in describing the interview process because this is, it turns out, somewhat misleading. Individuals came to this thinking that it was a very informal process when, in fact, it really is quite formal. And as a result, perhaps they should have brought legal counsel and did not. And they also were somewhat put off by then coming for what they thought was a pretty informal process, only to have it turn out that it was quite formal and quite intimidating to apparently some of them. We've addressed that in this bill by removing the term formal. Second, the language in the Dash 1 amendments makes it clear that the Health Division can take into account disciplinary actions which have already been completed by the employer or the supervising physician as the division goes through then its consideration of appropriate sanctions. Third, the language limits investigations and discipline of off-duty EMT conduct. This to make sure that that conduct which is considered would reasonably be connected with then their ability to perform their duties while on duty. That is included in the Dash 1 amendments. We wish to enter one point of clarification for the record. It's agreed by all that the employer or supervising physician disciplinary actions that must be considered are only those which are complete and related to the same event or set of events that is prompting the Health Division professional standards officer to act. This means that the Health Division does not have to wait for the completion or the initiation of other external disciplinary processes before beginning its own investigation and making its own findings. It only considers completed external disciplinary processes and actions. Thank you for your consideration. We would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Barnhart.
Thank you. On your second point, I'm curious as to what the bill contemplates or what the people who will be conducting these hearings contemplate the purpose will be of using information which comes from an employer or a supervising physician. I mean, is this information which will be used to establish the facts of the case, or is it to be used to in some other way? What's the point of that?
Chair Cruz, Representative Barnhart, the issue is here not to take their actions as findings of fact. That is established by our interview process itself. The issue here is if an employer or a supervising physician has already taken action which they feel are appropriate for discipline for this EMT, rather than be totally left on our own to then do our own thing, which may be double jeopardy, I think some people were feeling, then we can take into account what they have already done and consider that then for what we think appropriate action might be. So it isn't to have the employer do their thing and then do ours totally independently. If they have already completed some disciplinary action, we now have the opportunity to take that into account as we then determine what is appropriate.
Okay, follow up, if I may. Then it sounds like you're saying that in some cases you might say, well, the employer's taking care of that. We don't need to do anything. And in other cases, you might say, well, the employer fired him, so we're going to remove their ability to work in this field?
Yes.
Those
would be among the choices, Chair Cruz and Representative Barnhart. That's right. We now can take that into account, and if we feel that they were more than taken to task and appropriate discipline was applied, then fine. If we feel that it was not sufficient, not appropriate, that doesn't keep us then from doing what we feel is appropriate as well.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Grard.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I need you to explain, if you can, on page 2 of the bill. It starts with line 15 through 18, and it reads, the division may investigate the off-duty conduct of an EMT, and the word only is crossed out, to the extent that such conduct may reasonably raise questions about the ability of the EMT to perform the duties of an EMT in accordance with the standards established by this chapter. Could you explain what the intent of that is, please?
Chair Cruz, Representative Girard, the intent is to make clear the extent to which we can take into account activity off-duty that may have an influence on how the EMT may conduct themselves on-duty. With regard to removing the term only, I think that that was felt that it was redundant, that it wasn't needed. The issue here is that there are many activities which EMTs may engage in off-duty which may have an influence on how they would perform on-duty, such as sexual misconduct, drug abuse, alcoholism, theft, anger control. There are, for example, we had a case, unfortunately, about 2 years ago where an EMT hit a patient while in the back of the ambulance. And I think it would be fair to say that that was a result of not having anger control. Perhaps if we had been vigilant and looking at off-duty conduct, and it turned out that there were examples of the lack of control, lack of anger control. Those things we feel that the statute makes very clear that the Health Division has a responsibility to reasonably look at things that are off-duty that may affect the conduct of an EMT while they are on duty, and dealing with patients which are extremely vulnerable, could not be many times unconscious, and their conduct in those situations or their conduct as an EMT having ready access to drugs, if they have a drug problem, that perhaps has reasonable implications with regard to their conduct on duty.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a firefighter paramedic here in Salem. I think the previous speaker did a very eloquent job of explaining what this bill does and the purpose why we need to have this in the legislative process. The only thing that I would add is that, in our opinion, I believe that this will improve the process not only from a investigatory stance and improve process for due process, but I think that it will also improve the way that citizens are served by EMTs and paramedics within the state of Oregon. And finally, the only thing that I would like to add as far as the record, and I believe that Committee Administrator Lewis has already received a copy of this, but I'd like to have it on the record that both Bill Spirey and Fire Chief Dennis Murphy from the City of Springfield are also in support of this bill, and there is a letter to that effect that's within your records. And with that, I would just like to say we appreciate the cooperation that we've had working with the Oregon Health Division to work out a bill that we can reach consensus on and bring it forward to this legislative policy body to hopefully unanimously support this bill. And with that, I'd ask answer any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that Representative Leonard has seen and accepts the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Rest assured, if we were doing something with one of his bills that he didn't like, he would be here.
He would be here.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I don't have a copy of the letter that you have referenced.
Representative Tomei, behind your staff measure summary, in the packet that I sent out, I attached the copy.
Thank you. I stand corrected.
In the staff measure summary.
Oh, really?
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if either one of you can answer this question. Maybe Tom, Mr. Johnson, you can. And that is, referring to the hand engrossed version that we have, I noticed that refusing an invitation for an interview with the division as specified in this section is above where it even talks about the interview process. And I'm just curious as to, and maybe that's just a legal, technical sort of a deal that Legislative Council does, and they did it that way because, and so.
Chair Cruz, Representative Crummell, I'm sorry I can't answer your question. I'm also supposing that it's just a function of how they happen to draft the language.
And in follow-up, Mr. Chair, actually it's not a question, it's more, maybe it is a question. And that is with regards to the interview. You mentioned that because in the statute before it said the language that we're taking out, it said that it was an informal. So you basically are taking out the word informal. So what does the interview, I guess, consist of without getting into, a 10-minute dissertation, but
I'll try to make it quick. Chair Cruz, Representative Crummell, when assertions come, either by way of complaint or sometimes a request for confidentiality of complaint or report from hospitals, report from patients, whatnot, we are charged with the responsibility then of investigating alleged or sometimes pretty evident inappropriate action on the part of the EMT. We gather some facts as much as we can, but many times, in fact, it's really essential that ultimately then there is an interview with the person against whom complaints have been received. This is before the formal hearing of a disciplinary hearing where we have a hearing officer. It's really a matter that I suppose, if there is an analogy, it would be like a police interview it's part of, a major part of, finding the facts, getting the other side of the story.
Thank you.
Representative Morstadt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to comment on the letter of support by Chief Dennis Murphy of Springfield, who I worked with for 10 years, actually 12. Dennis is state and national recipient of awards for the program that he runs, has very high standards, and I'm impressed that he did endorse this. Well, it doesn't surprise me that he did, but I think it's important to note that he did support this.
Mr. Chair, if I could, this perhaps is a good opportunity. I, too, would like to express appreciation for the very cooperative, constructive way in which the Firefighters Council brought this issue forward. We were able to talk. Certainly, the Health Division wishes to make this process, which is an essential process, as respectful to the EMT, the person under investigation, as we can. We do not wish it to be intimidating or bullying or go about a process which puts anybody off guard and that they're not prepared for. So we want to make this process as respectable, as supportive as we can. The purpose is not to punish these EMTs, but to find the facts and to assure that the citizens of this state who are in the custody of EMTs have a reasonable assurance that they are not going to be exposed then to individuals who may in some way treat them inappropriately.
Senator Gerard.
Sorry to come back on down there. I'm on the engrossed version again, page 3A, line 11. Take disciplinary action as the division in its discretion finds proper. which includes, if I'm reading this properly, that you could come back and level a civil penalty against the individual for $5,000 or the cost of the proceedings. Is that correct?
Chair Cruz and Representative Girard, there is a fair amount of discretion given to the division. And I think that we view that very seriously. I think our record is a good one. I can tell you that we are not going to... The problem is trying to find language which provides that balance that I spoke to originally. Yes, there is discretion there. But certainly we feel that this discretion is something that we need to guard very carefully. If we misuse it, we certainly are open to that. And I think that is the spirit within which the firefighters came to us, and we're very responsive to that. I honestly don't know, Chair Cruz and Representative Girard, how to construct the language which gives the flexibility to meet a wide array of circumstances that we run into with regard to EMTs, from, on the one hand, people getting drunk and being in an accident. Yes, there's an alcoholism problem, but in this case, it was the first time it was, in fact, on their way home from an opportunity to celebrate their getting an EMT certificate.
Oh.
You know? That kind of thing with somebody who has a real alcohol problem. There is a need for, I think, my impression is, some real discretion. But we recognize the potentials for abuse of that, and we want to make sure that there are appropriate oversights to make sure that we don't abuse that.
Okay. And while I certainly accept that, I think you're a very fair man, and I don't mean to impugn that whatsoever. Would this affect volunteer EMTs?
Chair Cruz and Representative Girard, yes, it will. It will affect all EMTs.
Follow up again. Now I have a greater concern. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to hold volunteer EMTs to the same levels of off-duty performance as you do a full-time EMT.
Chair Cruz and Representative Girard, yes, that is right. We recognize that in many areas of the state, volunteers many times are encouraged by us, by encouraged by the local ambulance service, to please come down and sign up, take an EMT course, become an EMT. We need you. Our unit is shorthanded. We need people. And then on the other hand, they do their best sometimes, and they live their life normally, and then the potential is that we will, on the other hand, say, oh, well, by the way, since you did that, now we're going to discipline you. That has been a dichotomy which we have faced for a long time. We are aware of that, but on the other hand, back to the balancing thing, when citizens of this state are in the custody of EMTs in extremely vulnerable situations, perhaps going to a home where no one else is there, being exposed to all sorts of things within the home, we take very seriously the responsibility to take reasonable action to assure that those individuals are not going to be an unacceptable risk to those members of the public which they come in contact with. We try to balance that.
One last. I just want to get this all in my mind. You're going to take volunteers who use money out of their own pockets to receive the training. They pay for it. They're going to pay for their certificate. They're going to pay for their license. They're going to pay for their expenses. And they have another full-time job, one would assume. So they go out after work, have a beer, and their pager goes off, that there's an emergency call, and they're the closest person there that can make the difference between saving a life and not saving a life. So that person goes on that call, and if an error is made, God forbid, you're going to fine that individual $5,000, suspend his license and keep him or her from ever being an EMT again.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, in that case, clearly we would not. In fact, very few of the complaints that come to us, very few of the investigations which we conduct actually end up in disciplinary action. Again, our purpose is to make things better, to support that EMT. In this situation which you hypothetically described, I cannot in any way envision us taking action. I think we would have a talk with the individual, see what they've learned, assess the situation, perhaps bring it to the attention of the supervising physician so that there could be someone look at them to see how they're doing, and that would be the end of the case.
The problem I have is that it's possible.
Yes, it is possible. And that's, if you can find a better language, we certainly want that. I think there does need to be discretion there. We have worked as best we can to find that balance, and I think that there are in place review processes for the Attorney General's office, which we work very closely with, that has to be involved in all of our cases that go to hearing. Our internal review processes themselves, organizations such as these, which represent the EMTs themselves, and the public. I don't think that it would be accurate to come away with the impression that there aren't some checks and balances there. There are, in addition to what I appreciate your recognition, and hopefully I'm worthy of it, recognition that we try to do a good job.
Thank you. Appreciate your response.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that, and I think this is in, by way of follow-up, really, that you've asked for two additional things that you can do by way of discipline. A lot of reprimand and a lot of instruction, and I assume that cover some of the areas that we were just talking about.
Thank you very much, Representative Bernhard. Representative Chair, Chair Cruz, yes, that's exactly right. While we have used those tools in the past, they were excluded from what would have been considered formal discipline, and now they are, and it will get at exactly those things, those hypothetical cases that Representative Gerard was talking about. Thank you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like a clarification or a definition. Paramedics and EMTs, they be considered the same.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson. Yes, there's three levels in the state of Oregon. There's an emergency medical technician basic, emergency medical technician intermediate, emergency medical technician paramedic. So, yeah, they're all encompassed in the same definition. Right. That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3479 and going to work session on House Bill 3479. Representative Barnhart.
Move the dash ones.
Representative Barnhart moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 3479. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Barnhart.
Move the House Bill 3479 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 3479 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I would just point out, Mr. Chair, that
Representative Crummell,
if I may. Thank you. I would just point out that it's very important that we have strong disciplinary measures, I guess, for people that are involved in areas like being EMTs, medical doctors, athletic trainers, nurses, and so on. Because in those situations, you are dealing with life, many times with life and death matters. And while I recognize and understand some of the concerns that were raised by Representative Gerard, and I appreciate them, when a person, even as a volunteer, steps up to do that type of a job, They are setting themselves apart from the general public. And any time that you're on call, or that there's a chance that you can be called, you basically have a responsibility not only to yourself but to the people that you may be serving when you answer that call, to be in the most straight frame of mind possible, from a standpoint that you have not had any kind of intoxicants or drugs or anything that could impair your ability to perform the duties that you're going to perform. And so I understand, I appreciate the things that Mr. Johnson was saying about, you know, in that kind of a hypothetical situation, but I think that we just need to note that people that do accept these types of responsibilities are expected to be, I guess, just sort of a little bit above what we might expect from the general public.
Yeah, discussion. Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Montanison?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Barhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 3479, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Carrier?
Leonard? Representative Lennon, this bill.
You talk too long. Representative Barnhart, there he is.
I'd be happy to, unless Representative Leonard wants to.
You can check with him if we need to change. We can do that. Representative Barnhart. I said that in good humor, by the way. And that will close the work session on House Bill 2479. And now that the preliminaries are done, I'm going to allow the committee to stand at ease for 5 minutes, just to kind of get our breath before we go into this next one, because it's going to take a little while. So 5 minutes is okay? Okay.
Which is?